Welcome to the Logstat, the Army's premier podcast on all things sustainment, where we analyze new developments, discuss current trends, and forge the path ahead for the next generation of sustainment soldiers. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Logstat. I'm your host, Captain Garrett Powell. Right now, we've had an honor to be able to have Sustainment Week going on right now. So we have a variety of leaders across the sustainment community and across the Army all meeting to see all the new innovations that's happening across the force right now. And on today, I'm going to be sitting down with Major General Curtis Taylor. He's the Commanding General of the 1st Armored Division. He's going to be walking us through today about building a maintenance culture within the 1st Armored Division and kind of getting his insight into what that looks like, and especially what sustainers should expect within his formation and where they're taking their maintenance culture. And with that, sir, I'd like to pass over you, get a quick introduction for the community.
Well, Garrett, thank you so much for having me. And just to the sustainment community altogether, thank you for inviting me for this Sustainment Week. I had the opportunity to present in a panel this morning about division commander perspective on sustainment. I started off by saying that as an armor officer, I was told on day one that my secondary MOS was to be a sustainer. In my 32 years of doing this, I'd say I've been 70% sustainment, 30% maneuver, because that's just the nature of armor and mounted operations. That's absolutely true in the 1st Armored Division. We lived and die by our sustainers. And I have so much respect for our mechanics, our fuelers, our logisticians, our supply technicians, all those folks who make the division operate. We couldn't do it without them. Just a little bit of perspective. I've been in command for almost 2 years now, so I'm getting near the end of my time. Had the opportunity to do a warfighter right off the bat as a division, and then deploy the division to Europe, where we spent the last 9 months operating across 8 countries and 23 different outstations. So talk a lot about extended logistics there. And then brought the division back, and now we're preparing to take over the southern border mission here in just a few weeks. But look forward to having a great discussion, talking about maintenance, and talking about how important sustainment is to the 1st Armored Division.
So before we get into the full maintenance side of the culture that within your formation, you talked about, you're an armor officer, but you've had so much of your time built into sustainment.
Yeah.
What has that been like trying to balance being that armor officer and then working with the sustainers?
Well, as a young officer, I was a tank platoon leader like every young officer, and then I got put in a support platoon back in the day when we had 19 alphas leading our distribution platoons. And then I went right from there to being a battalion maintenance officer. So if you look at my first 3 years in the Army, I had one armor job and 2 sustainment jobs. But what I learned from that experience up front was that just how important the maintenance and distribution side of mounted operations are. And if you don't embrace that as a maneuverist, then you're an amateur. And we've all heard the statement that amateurs talk tactics and professionals talk logistics. That's mostly true. What I would say is, any tactician worth his salt understands that his success is based on is the depth of his understanding on sustainment. And that's been true from the platoon level all the way up to the division. We operate at the tempo that we can sustain. And so anybody who pretends to be, who would like to be an effective warfighter has got to understand the sustainment warfighting function in great detail, particularly in the mounted formations.
Yeah, you have just the amount of fuel, five. I've had a variety of different conversations sitting down. It's like, how was it like to be in the Armored Brigade Combat Team and trying to support that? Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, we've had some different conversations, like how that's changing with the focus now on LISCO as well as with TIC and how those formations are changing, especially for maybe like a junior sustainer out there. What advice would you give them with like a junior sustainer interacting with armor? Like, I'm a brand new lieutenant. I got to go work with my armor counterparts. What would you tell a sustainer like that?
Yeah, I'd say the first thing you need to be able to do is describe your capabilities and make sure that you communicate and articulate what you're capable of doing and how you can deliver that capability to the fight. The armor community, the way that armor formations fight is very fast-paced. It is very demanding because the operational tempo requires it to be, and it requires a lot of improvisation, I would describe. My experience, for example, in Ranger School, I spent a lot of time planning actions on the objective in great detail, and because the pace and tempo of dismounted operations allows you to do that. In armor operations, while the detail planning is just as important, it's like jazz music. You are improvising the minute you cross the LD. Mm-hmm. All the more reason why you've got a plan. So I would tell you, be flexible, be adaptable, and always be thinking about contingencies. The best sustainers I had, that I've had the privilege to work with, have an understanding and the ability to visualize tomorrow's problem set. Because we're all pretty familiar with what's going wrong today and what needs our attention today. But great sustainers look at the next 24 hours of operations. They're proactive in the next, depending on the echelon. If you get a division, you're way beyond 24. You're looking at 96 hours out. And they're looking at, okay, this is the problem today. I don't have enough mechanics. I've lost all my distribution capability. We're fighting our way through the mountains. But I know 72 hours from now, I'm going to be at the river's edge. And what challenges am I going to have to get across that river? And how am I preparing my formation now for that future challenge? So for young officers, I would tell you, your ability to improvise and to plan in order so that you can improvise, to understand branches and sequels, and your ability to anticipate future requirements are key to success in this environment.
Exactly. And definitely thank you very much, because yeah. I know I get, having been an instructor here, mm-hmm. that's a lot of conversations we have when I was teaching the captains. These are, captains about to go off and take company command, and here we're going through and planning with our individual concept of support is, you're planning for an armored division, moving across the battlefield, like, how do I support that? And you're going to have those students then go out and actually do that for real life.
Yeah.
And it always goes back to, okay, how do we integrate with the combat arms as mm-hmm. sustainers? One of the things that we talk about, like, okay, I go out there, I do my rehearsal support. How do I make sure that they're there with us to make sure? Because it's like, I told you the plan.
Yeah.
But then they didn't follow the plan. So I know there can be some back and forth with that.
Well, let me offer a vignette on this since you bring this up. Prior to taking command of the 1st Armored Division, I had the incredible opportunity to command the National Training Center for 3 years. Incredible job. Loved it. Watched 28 rotations come through the box and got to spend an awful lot of time and a lot of BSAs over that three-year time and a lot of log packs and see a lot of sustainment operations.
Can only imagine.
Yeah, everything. It was great. I loved it. What a wonderful job. Spent most of the 3 years with my helmet on out there in the field doing great Army training. What I saw, and just for your junior sustainment officers, what I saw the very best FSC commanders do, first, they understood that their place of duty was in the brigade support area. They were the field trains, if you understand doctrinally what that means. That means that they were back outside of artillery range. They weren't snuggled up next to the battalion commander. They'd built a trusting relationship with that battalion commander before they ever got to NTC, and then they were back at the brigade support area. It quite often dispersed, widely dispersed in a protective posture, so they weren't subject to artillery. But their overriding passion every day, the number one thing that an FSC commander needs to do in LISCO every day is the creation and timely delivery of the logistics package. And so an FSC commander, most important thing he does every day is he receives that log stat from the S4. He analyzes the log stat. He makes sure it makes a lot of sense and that he understands what it is. And then he relentlessly pursues the creation of those requirements, that logistics status, into a logistics package, a log pack. Mm-hmm. And then he assembles the log pack, and he establishes, in conjunction with the battalion sergeant major, he establishes a logistics rally point time. He knows if that time is, let's say, 1600, he knows it'll take him 72 minutes from the minute he rolls out the gate of the or he departs the BSA. So he plans out, at 1448, if I'm doing my math right, he is rolling out. And to the minute, he rolls up to that logistics rally point, and his command sergeant major then distributes the logistics packages to the companies. He receives them back 2 hours later, and he goes back. Now, that sounds simple, but it's so very hard to do to a discipline standard. Then the important thing, the true test of our great FSC commanders is once you get back, you got a bunch of empty fuelers. And a great sustainer hates empty fuelers, particularly with our armor formations, because that Abrams tank will suck down gas in a heartbeat. So the first thing that commander does once he gets back, I know you're tired, I know you've been working for 12, 18 hours, you haven't slept. You're not doing anything until you go fuel up that fueler. And you go to the distribution company, the alpha company of the BSB, and you fuel up those fuelers. So then we're passing our logistics forward, and we're filling up our tactical distribution supply, our retail distribution supplies, enabling the CSSB or the DSSB to deliver fuel to the BSA effectively. When that system works, it runs great. When the FSC commander misunderstands their role or thinks that they should be snuggled up at the battalion command post and not back at the BSA building that log pack, then you end up with so many of the sustainment problems that cause our battalions to run out of gas, that causes our artillery formations to run out of ammunition, or causes us to have to do a maintenance hold on training day 9 because we haven't delivered any parts to the units yet.
Exactly. Well, that's amazing wisdom right there. So there you have it, folks. I mean, from, you said 28 rotations?
28 rotations. 28 rotations. 51 altogether. 28 as the as lead six out there.
So you said 28 there, then 58. So 51 your entire career?
Yeah, 51 rotations my entire career.
Wow. So do you at this point have a plot of land out there?
Well, just I love it. I'll tell you, there's no better place than our combat training centers to truly validate our go-to-war readiness. We can all sit around and talk about war fighting. But until you get out there in the dirt and prove that you can do it under the demanding conditions of a place like JRTC in the pouring rain, or JMRC when the snow is on the ground, or the NTC when it's 110 degrees and the wind is blowing you sideways, that is where we really prove ourselves. And there's a lot of armies in the world that talk about war fighting, but we're the only one that does that consistently. I believe that our combat training centers are the crown jewels of the Army. And by the way, I'll just tell you, if you want to get a PhD in warfighting as a maintainer, as a artilleryman, as a maneuver officer, or a logistician, go to the NTC as an OC. Mm-hmm. I fell in love with that place as a young officer, as a captain, when I got assigned out there as an OC, and just loved it, because you really do get a PhD in warfighting.
One of my best friends, he's a signal officer, and he did his time as an OC.
Yeah.
We served together in Alaska, and he did it, and he loved it down there.
Yeah.
Just the rotations.
And I'll tell you, I'm going to speak for NTC, but I think my the other CTCs would say the same. I spent more time in the field and more time with my family than any other assignment I've had as an OC at the NTC. Because I was either out with my helmet on, training soldiers on how to transition from movement to maneuver, probable line of contact, or sustain themselves over difficult terrain, or I was back taking my kids to the pool. Those are the two things that matter to me: war fighting and taking care of my family. I got to do both. I loved it. It's a great assignment.
That's good to hear that you have that balance, work-life balance. Mm-hmm. But thank you very much for going over that. Now it's kind of transition to what are the focus of today is building that maintenance culture within your division. Being a heavy division, being an armed brigade combat team, like that is maintenance is your lifeblood right there. Yep. If you don't have a good maintenance, then you're not going to be able to fight.
Yeah.
So how have you been able to build a good maintenance culture within your formation?
Well, I've learned a lot in 2 years of being a division commander. And I thought some of the things I thought were important when I first got in are less important. And what I've really learned is the most important thing I can do as a division commander to improve the readiness of my formation, to save op tempo and time for my soldiers so they do get some downtime, and to drive down costs. There's one thing I can do that improves all three of those, and that is certifying our operators and our mechanics on the technical skills required to maintain their equipment. Mm-hmm. And that sounds simple, and everybody thinks it's someone else's job to do that. So the institution is saying it's the operational forces job to train folks. The operational force is saying the institution needs to train and certify folks before they get to us. It's all of our responsibilities. And so the foundation of the maintenance program inside the Iron Division is this. We have a rigorous program to certify operators. Mm-hmm. That's tankers, that's truck drivers, that's Bradley operators, that's our Paladin crewmen. A rigorous program to certify them on the maintenance tasks necessary to operate their vehicles. And then we have a program of continuing education to certify our mechanics at echelon on the skills they need to develop. So that's the first and most important thing. To do that, we developed two programs in the 1st Armored Division. The first is called Maintenance Skills Testing. It's not very fancy. It basically takes a program that's well known inside the armor community called Gunnery Skills Testing, where you have to demonstrate competency of about 20 procedural tasks, how to bore sight your tank, how to take apart the machine guns and put them back together again, all that. It's a certification exercise that's familiar to every tanker and every Bradley operator. We've taken that and we said, okay, let's make an equivalent for maintenance. So we developed 10 work packages that General Dynamics helped us come up with. These are the skills that are most useful: track tension, air induction, you know, slave starting, those kinds of things. And we've said, we're going to certify these skills to the same rigor that we do the gunnery skills testing. In fact, I've taken it a step further and said, E3B standards. So the same way we do a good E3B in a good unit, we're going to do maintenance skills testing the same way. And so we've had a couple of units really take this on. And I'll tell you, Garrett, we've seen a huge drop in things like engine failures. So the AGT 1500 engine is a pretty complex engine. It's a jet engine. If you don't do air induction right, if you don't properly seal your plenum seals, you're going to blow an engine. So we've seen a huge drop in our engine failures because now we're testing people on how to properly close the plenum seals when they pull the V-packs. You know, helping our operators understand the importance of torque. When we say 200 foot-pounds, we mean 200 foot-pounds. Why is that so important? So we're really training and certifying our operators on how to do preventive maintenance checks and services with the same rigor as we do gunnery skills testing or E3B.
Is this an annual thing, or is this?
Yes. The intent is that it's the way we timed it out is it's supposed to be done just prior to services because it provides a defining event in the life cycle of a formation to schedule that and to do that. But there's a couple different ways to do that. I think at a minimum it needs to be done annually, but it is done to EIB standards in terms of the rigor. That's the first program. The second program that we developed at the 1st Armored Division is called the Ground Maintenance Training Program. Again, there's nothing fancy about it. We took the Aviation Maintenance Training Program, AMTP, defined in Training Circular 3-04.71. We took that and we just changed one letter, changed it from aviation to ground. We said, we want what our aviation community has. What it requires is that every mechanic in the division, we started with our 91 Alphas and we're moving to 91 Mikes and then we'll expand it across the Bravos and the rest of the mechanics. Every mechanic in the division is required to certify at a different maintenance level from ML1 to ML4 every year in the birth month. This is what the aviation community has done for years. Our ML1s are kind of entry level. They demonstrate a basic knowledge to do basically what AI, they prove that they have learned and understood to do what AIT taught them to do in terms of the maintenance of their vehicle, of a vehicle. ML2 is a little bit more complex generally for our sergeants. And we're starting to get into some diagnostic techniques. ML3 then is our expert maintainers and diagnosticians, generally E5, E6. And then the ML4 level is our master technicians. You give them a badge they get to wear. Once they're certified, they get to wear it for a year and they recertify every birth month. And then they move up the technical ladder. So we're no longer assuming a direct correlation between pay grade and expertise. Instead, what we're you've got to prove your expertise through a rigorous certification program. Not inventing anything new. We're just taking the aviation program and adapting it to the ground force. Now, here's the results of what we've seen. We started this first in 1st Brigade. We're moving to 2nd Brigade as they come off the southern border. And 3rd Brigade will begin a pretty deliberate program here this summer to implement that inside their formation. Where we have implemented ground maintenance training program, we are seeing a significant drop in cost and in the amount of time our mechanics spend working late and working and fixing their vehicles because that technical expertise matters. Just those two programs, we think, are saving us millions of dollars a year and also saving our soldiers time. We're also seeing there's a lot of reasons why, but we're seeing about a 10% increase and our overall readiness rate across the division. And there's a lot of good reasons. The enterprise has been very helpful. So I don't want to attribute all that to MST and GMTP, but that certainly has been contributing to it. On the wheeled side, we've asked DEVCOM to come in and help us with advanced diagnostics training. And it's amazing. Our young mechanics they love this kind of experience. They didn't join the Army to be part swappers. They joined the Army to be diagnosticians, and the DEVCOM advanced diagnostic training that we give them gives them master skills in how to diagnose faults, to read wiring diagrams, to understand amperage and voltage, to understand the diagnostic systems that are available on our wheeled fleets. And then we install, we give them diagnostic software, just like you have at any mechanic shop, that they can use and operate. And we install digital source collectors on our vehicles, our HETs, our PLSs, that allow them to leverage that data. So every time we've invested in our mechanics and we've invested in maintenance training for our operators, we see an increase in readiness and a drop in cost. And so that is the foundation of our maintenance training program, of our maintenance program in the First Armor Division, and probably the piece I'm most proud about. I got two others. I'll hit these real quick. The second line of effort in our maintenance program in the division is advanced manufacturing. So we know now that we can buy or we can produce an awful lot of parts that are otherwise difficult to get through the supply system. So as a division, we consolidated all our allied trades into a facility we call the Iron Forge. And then we bought them about $1 million worth of 3D manufacturing, advanced manufacturing capability. Some steel cutting board capability, some polymers, polymer advanced manufacturing. And put that together with some great technicians. What we've done so far is just in about 4 months, we produced over 1,000 parts. More importantly, we've saved over 9,000 days on our ESR. So 9,000 days of deadline maintenance that we have been able to eliminate by the production of those parts.
Wow.
So I'm a huge believer in this. I believe that we scan at the UMCP level. So we're buying scanners for all of our battalion maintenance teams. And then we, at the division level is where we do most of the parts production. But we're seeing a huge drop in costs. I'm happy to talk more about that. The last thing that we're working on, and I don't want to oversell this because we haven't gotten there yet, it's called root cause analysis. So the civilian world's doing this. Boeing has a program that they've been doing for years where if an engine fails before it was supposed to fail, before it was predicted to fail, they do this very detailed analysis that tries to understand why did this engine fail? And what they found is the vast majority of reasons why are human error. We know this. The number one reason why a component fails before it should have is because of some kind of human error. But it's not always a discipline problem. In many cases, it's a failure to train somebody properly. It's a failure to give them the right tools. We're asking too much of our mechanics. We're not giving them the proper conditions for them to, you know, we're not giving them a torque wrench to install something that has a very specific torque, you know, something like that. And so what Boeing has figured out is if you drive down to the root cause in all these, you can learn great lessons that you can then cycle back into the system. So this program became so popular that now nearly every aviation maintenance company in the nation does that. It's certified by the FAA. And so we need to do more of that. We need to leverage the big data systems that we have and understand where the data tells us we've got a training problem. Let me give you an example. So a couple months ago, we had a battalion out at JMRC conducting a rotation. And the battalion blew, it was about 11 generator shafts on 11 tanks. It's not bad. I mean, it is kind of bad. It's higher than you would expect, but not terribly surprising. If you know anything about the tank, the generator shaft generally blows when you improperly slave start it or you shift gears prematurely before the tank has had time to power up. But then we looked at the distribution of those 11 generator shafts, and like 9 of them were in one company, 5 were in one platoon, and like 3 were on one tank. And you look at that distribution and say, wow, I've got a pretty focused training problem here. Well, one, I need to go find the tank crew that blew 3 generator shafts in 8 days. So we got after that. And then we started realizing we had some training problems. And then we had some folks that didn't understand because driver's training wasn't done to standard. But understanding the data allowed us to attack the problem rather than just buying more generator shafts. And so we're doing that. We do engine boards when we blow engines now. And we're really looking, what is the root cause analysis? I'm trying to leverage Weapons 360 to better understand the distribution of the maintenance costs that I have across the division, so that I can understand where that leadership intervention is. So that's really the maintenance program in the First Armor Division. It starts with mechanic and operator certification as the foundation, the most important piece. Advanced manufacturing to help us attack the long lead time parts problem. And then finally, root cause analysis using big data to understand where I've got training deficiencies.
So I'm just going to steal that. No, bro. Yeah. But that's awesome, especially as me who's about to head off to ILE, go be a battalion XO soon. That's a great way to
be. You're going to be living that. Yeah.
Be living that day and night, drinking that Kool-Aid very much. But no, this is a fantastic program that your unit has established. As you call it, the maintenance skills test, and then it's the ground maintenance training program.
Yep.
And what I really like about what you brought there, it's the way you go up in the skills program, it's not restricted to rank.
Right.
And I really like that because especially as you get some junior soldiers in there who have a strong maintenance background, maybe they've done like air mechanics before they got into the Army, they're going to have that good foundation. And now they're not restricted. Oh, just because I'm a private or I'm a specialist, I can't go up. But now because expertise really does not know rank, we all bring in different wisdom from our background. Now I can walk up and say, hey, that might be, you know, prior first class, you said that, how do you saw it? The master was the top one?
Yeah, the master would be the ML4.
ML4, like, I know this person is going to have, you know, they're going to be very squared away or know what they're talking about. And that's also going to build competition and motivation, I can imagine, within that formation. Be like, I got to keep going, get the higher.
The civilian world has figured this out. And what they do is they pay for expertise, right? Mm-hmm. And so I would love to live in a world where, let's say we've got an E5 or an E6, probably an E6 who's ML4 certified, which is pretty good. Mm-hmm. Because the ML4 certification, I mean, that's a lifetime of learning. So I'd love to be able to offer that guy a reenlistment bonus of, you know, many tens of thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. And I just proposed that to our most senior sustainers. I think the opportunity, I mean, just think about the money you would save if you could offer a expert mechanic, hey, give me 6 more years in the Army and I'm going to give you a check that you've never seen before in your life. Because I know in a year you're going to earn that back because of your advanced diagnostic techniques. And because your intimate knowledge of the formation of the equipment that we have. And so the civilian world who offer is very attuned to profit and return on investment has long ago figured out that paying for that level of expertise is well worth it. And we need to do the same. And I think the ML4 gives us a way to do that. Mm-hmm. The other thing I also want to do is I want to integrate it with the ASE, automotive skills. I can't remember what the E stands for. The automotive skills program that you see in the civilian world. When you take your car to a mechanic, a dealership, you may notice that the mechanic generally will have an ASE patch on his shoulder if he's wearing some kind of uniform for the wherever he's working. And that's a very important credential in our maintenance world. And we ought to integrate our certification with the ASE program.
Now, has this... for this program, we thought about moving to like with promotion points, like making that connection. Hey, the more you go up, you get some promotion points with that.
What we've done is we've taken the program, we built it up, we piloted it, and now we've given it to the Ordnance School. And I want to thank Rob Montgomery and the great leaders here at the Ordnance School because they've really taken it on. What they do with it next, and can we tie it to, you know, some kind of mechanics badge, or can we allow the ML level badge to be worn in different installations? Mm-hmm. I want to leave that to them to sort out. What I can tell you is maintenance expertise is so valuable that we need to train it. That's the first thing we got to do. We need to certify it. That means you've got to prove back that you've learned what you're training. We need to incentivize it with badges and promotion points. And then we need to retain it with retention incentives. And so those are the four things I would tell you we need to do with the expertise that we're building.
That's amazing. Very amazing, yes, sir. So when we always look at it, you know, maintenance can be like the math problem.
Yeah.
And when it comes to working hours and all that, how have you balanced that equation how with your formation of maintainers being in the motor pool working? Are you protecting them? Are they still doing, like we always say, keep them away from gate guard? Like, how is that balance have you found to make sure they're doing their craft, keeping your fleet up and running compared to everything else they have to do?
Yeah, well, very simple. In 1st Armored Division, no 91 series or 92 series soldiers authorized to do any tasking that does not require 91 or 92 series expertise. And so there's no gate guard for mechanics. Mm-hmm. And that's a policy. I didn't even need to implement that policy. Every one of the brigade commanders was already doing it, but we just codified it and made sure that was clear across the board and standardized it. So, yes, we want our mechanics focused on their mission and focused on you know, the production of the maintenance requirements. Production control meetings is another really important task. And again, this is where the aviation community has kind of got a leg up on us. Every day in an aviation battalion, the day starts off with a production control meeting. And that's where we do what's called P3T4, where we look at the parts, personnel, and equipment, and do we have everything we need to perform a particular job. Then we assign an individual to a job. We ensure that they've got the right expertise, they've got the right tools to do that job. We give them how much time that job is supposed to take. By the way, this also happens in every dealership in America. And then we assign that task to them, and then they take that job. That's a good maintenance team runs a good production control meeting. So I think that that's a very important system because it provides predictability for our mechanics. So it's not just the hey you, the continual hey you. The other thing I've kind of backed off a little bit is, and this took me a while to get used to, OR rate, operational readiness rate as a percentage is a metric. And we all know that metrics, anytime you chase a metric, you get dysfunctional outcomes. It's like stock price. Okay, anybody who's worked in a corporation will tell you that stock price is a snapshot in time. Yes, is it correlated with overall performance? Yes. Does it matter to your investors? Yes. But if you're constantly chasing stock price, you're going to hollow at your organization in pretty important ways. I don't want a high OR rate. I want an accurate one. And so I'm very clear about that. And so I've taken the pressure off my battalion and brigade commanders to produce a particular OR rate. What I expect of them is if they have an 80% OR rate in the month leading up to gunnery, I'm not going to hassle them about it and say, hey, you got to get that to 90. Well, what we're going to do is, do you have the parts? Do you have the resources? What else do you need? What I'm really interested in is when the moment of decision comes, how many of your crews qualify off their own platform? That's the moment of decision. I want you to surge for the moment of truth. Same with NTC. You show up at the National Training Center with a 70% OR rate, but it's accurate. You will do better than a unit that shows up with a 95% OR rate. I see it all the time. Because what I want to see is a unit that when they're preparing for operations has a low OR rate, and when they're executing, they rise. As opposed to what we quite often see is a unit that has a very high OR rate when they're not being evaluated and self-evaluating. And then as the moment of truth comes, the OR rate plummets. And so honesty in reporting is foundational to effective maintenance culture. So if it's broke, say it's broke. And then we'll figure out, we'll work together to get it fixed. And then you could surge when it's time to cross the line of departure.
I like how you said that, sir, because how often they'll bring it there just to, like, it will just be pretty much drugged there.
Right.
And it's just barely work. Oh, yeah, it's good to go. Then you get there, it's like, oh, we've lost half the fleet because the equipment actually wasn't up.
Yeah. Well, it gets back to the perennial question that we always hear. It's the Thursday before a 4-day weekend, you got a tank deadline for whatever, and the part comes in. You know, it shows up. Are you going to spend the weekend to install that part? And my answer has been, first off, that decision is going to be made way down the chain of command, probably at the battalion level, battalion XO level, taking a hard look at, okay, what's the mission on Tuesday? What kind of op tempo have my mechanics been under? You know, who's got a family event on this 4-day weekend? And what makes sense for the formation in terms of generating overall readiness? What we're not going to do is say, well, we're going to lose 4 arbitrary down days if we allow this tank to remain deadline over the weekend. So looking at stock or looking at OR rate as an indication of where you are today and how you're surging for the next major training event or the next major operational requirement is the right way to look at it. Looking at it as an arbitrary measure of performance is the wrong way to look at it.
Well, definitely thank you for painting that picture for us, because we get so much locked in. You know, that's this vehicle is down, this tank is down, we have to surge, we have to do everything we can to get this up, but not taking into account all these other factors.
Right.
And that gets into my other part of the conversation is, what do you really expect from sustainers in your formation to help balance that as well as provide informative information up the chain to you?
Well, the first thing I expect from sustainers is you got to master process, right? You have to understand the maintenance process if you're in that business, and understand every step of it, understand where parts come from, how we make the determination on whether or not a part can be locally manufactured, locally purchased, or acquired from an alternate source of supply, understanding the process from OEM to our depots, and then down to the SSA, and then all the way onto the actual vehicle. So you've got to master that process. You have to master GCSS Army. It's an it's a pretty obtuse system. It is not inherently user friendly, but once you understand it, it can be a great tool. So great sustainers understand our systems of record. You also have to have a superior understanding of data. And I think the tools that we have now with Vantage and Weapons 360 give us enormous leverage that I didn't have when I was a BMO, and enormous visibility to see and understand what's going on across the enterprise. And great sustainers are really good at understanding those tools and leveraging them to make their formation more effective. The second thing is you have to be proactive. This is not what General George used to call a storefront business, where you just kind of put out your hours of operation and see if anybody comes and needs you, you know, and if nobody calls, there's no problems. You have to be very proactive. You have to be anticipatory. You have to be understanding future requirements and constantly leaning forward and saying, how can I add value as a sustainer in this formation? And then three, you have to be integrated with the formation you support. You've got to understand their battle rhythm, understand how they're flowing and conducting operations, and make sure that you are organizing your formation to best support the formation that you're oriented to help.
Yeah, that's why I looked at it as, especially as a sustainer, if there's not a seat at the table, you got to make yourself a seat at the table.
Absolutely.
Especially when you have that integration between sustainment and combat arms.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's not going to be open the door for you, hey, come on in. It's you got to make sure you get yourself in there.
Yeah.
Make yourself available. Show what capability, as you brought up, sir, you know, show your capabilities and show that value you bring to the force.
Yeah.
On that.
And the other thing you've got to deal with, and this is just inherent in being a sustainer, you will always have two bosses, at least two bosses. Generally, you have more than that. A field artilleryman is the same way. He always has two bosses. So get over it. Get used to it. That was a life choice. And you just got to learn to work both of those and understand the unique relationships you have with your sustainment, functional chain of command, and then your tactical chain of command, and then understanding what different lines of authority go up each one.
Yeah. So you've given us so much wisdom and knowledge today. Just really want to thank you for walking us through the maintenance culture within your formations. Is there anything else you wanted to highlight for the community today? Anything that deals with the maintenance culture within the 1st Armored Division or anything like that?
I just want to say again that in the 1st Armored Division, we move and operate at the pace of our sustainers. We've got some incredible sustainers in our DSB and in each one of our brigade support battalions. They're the hardest working people in the division. All my tankers and infantrymen, no apologies for that. That's a fact. And we ask an awful lot of these great mechanics and great sustainers and great logisticians that we have. And we couldn't execute our mission without them. We really appreciate the way that the enterprise, particularly in the last 2 years, has really focused on how do we fix some of the hard problems we've got. I mean, great programs like the ORP program, which is harvesting our vehicles and sending them back to the depot. Freedom Reaper, which has taken some of our category co-condition F vehicles off our hands so that we can get them back as seed for future fleets, have really helped to unburden our units and our sustainers from maintenance problems that were beyond their capacity to solve. And so I appreciate what the enterprise is doing. And I appreciate most of all the great talent that they fill the 1st Armored Division with every day.
Thank you. And then is there any other wisdom you have for this? I know you have a lot you've given already today, specific to this, to the sustainment community, even outside of the maintenance culture we went over today.
I do want to address one thing real quick. I just last week I was at JMRC and got to see our units fighting. 1st Cav and 1st Armored Division were doing a rotation together. I got to see them fighting in an environment that was absolutely saturated with UAVs. And a Ukrainian formation had come over and was attacking our soldiers with UAVs, the same kind of technology they were using against the Russians. And we were blown away by just what a game changer that is. There is no training event. There's no battle drill. There's no activity that we do in a field environment right now that should not be reconsidered in light of the prevalence of the UAV threat. And so we've got to rethink how we do log pack. We've got to rethink how we position ourselves on the battlefield, how we use dispersion more effectively, how we conduct hasty logistics resupply points as opposed to standing resupply points, because the UAV threat is very, very real. And what we saw is in 5 days, the Ukrainians had completely changed the behavior of the brigade in the box. You could fly over the brigade and not see a single vehicle outside the wood line. Tanks covered up so much they looked like a bush, because we because these UAVs were so lethal. And so we've got to build that, export that kind of habitual behavior across the Army, or we're going to lose a lot of casualties in the first war. But we've really got to learn to adapt to an environment where everything that can be seen can be targeted. And I think that's going to be a major cultural change for our sustainment community as it is for the maneuver community.
Yeah, and as you brought up, so we're seeing that firsthand right now over in Europe, and just what a change that type of technology has done to our formations.
Yeah.
But thank you for that wisdom. And just really want to thank you for coming on the show today. Where can people reach out to you if they have follow-up questions? Like, how can they find you?
Yeah. So first name Curtis, last name Taylor. I think I'm the only one. I'm certainly the only one. It's a major general. So please hit me up on the global. I'd love to answer any questions. And I appreciate what you guys do to make the 1st Armored Division more successful every day.
Of course. Well, thank you very much, sir, for once again for coming on today's episode.
All right. Thanks for having me, Garrett.
Of course. So there you have it, folks. Another great episode today. Kind of go over the maintenance culture and seeing firsthand what it's like for the 1st Armored Division, how they've built that. We went over, as we saw, the maintenance skills test, the ground maintenance training program, a variety of others, just how they've turned their maintenance around, built that culture. So I highly implore you, take everything we've done today and add stuff like that to your formation. Model this program, because as we saw today with their results, it's going to take you tenfold. So get out there. See how you're doing your maintenance program. Talk to those around you. Reach out to your senior warrant officers who have lived and breathed this for generations. But just once again, thank you all very much for tuning in to another episode of The Log Stat. That is all we have today, folks. And as always, Sustainment Leaders start here. See you next time. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Log Stat. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Please share this episode across your formation and leave us a review. If you have a topic you'd like here discussed, then please reach out to us at armysustainment@army.mil or directly to me on global at garrett.h.pyle. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at the U.S. Army CASCOM page. We'll see you next time. Sustainment Leaders start here.